It's your life. Live it. Live on AWR SID Media, from broadcast to baptism.
So we have a fairly short chapter today. Chapter 17 of the book of Exodus reads as follows. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I going to do? What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massa and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight and fight the Amalekites, rather. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses' hand held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other side. So this, his hands remained steady still, unset, until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner," he said, for hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. "The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." May the Lord bless the reading of his word now and forever. Amen. What is your comments here?
I think what I'm getting out of this is how intricately connected God is in our lives, and how there is nothing that happens to us by chance, but it is all within the perfect will of God. And sometimes the will of God is not towards our desire, because that which we see in front of us is not the same view that God sees for us in that situation. But one thing for sure, if we can trust in the fact that God is on our side, and that everything that he's doing for us is going to end up glorifying his name as a God that provides, and also he will lift us up so that we can share in that glory, because we are going to be the end recipients that are going to receive something positive, because everything he's doing it for our goodwill and our purpose as well.
Okay. All right. Got it. So let's get into it, Mfundisi. The biggest takeaway from me from this chapter is how these people are vilified how these people are seen as unfaithful and ungrateful when they and their children and their livestock are thirsty. I mean, thirst has nothing to do with faith. I mean, we get thirsty and we get hungry. Is it wrong to be thirsty?
I don't think it's wrong to be thirsty, but I think it's wrong to actually lose sight of the fact that God is able and within himself is sufficient for everything that we need. And I think the biggest lesson here is that whatever it is that we want and we need, before we actually embark on solutions on how to acquire what we need, we should actually acknowledge the presence of God in everything. And I think this is just the same issue with the disciples. When Jesus was asking, what are we going to feed these people? They kept on bringing so many solutions to say that, I think Philip says that there's a boy here with 5 loaves and 2 fish. But just when he's about to get it right to say, Lord, I know with you this can become enough for everyone, he says, but what is that for so many people? And I think in a lot of ways, when we allow our fears to take over because of the situations that we're going through, we end up degrading and limiting God so that we say our problem is bigger than what God can provide. So the justification is there for the people to be thirsty. It's there for them to panic. It's there for them to wonder, where are we going to get water because we're in the middle of a desert? But if they saw the strong hand that led them out of Egypt, which was also an impossibility and a miracle by itself, then they should have known that this is about time that we say that our efforts are not going to help us out, but we need to rely on the God that was able to do things that are miraculous before.
What bothers me, Mfundisi, is that very train of thought that overlooks the obvious, in my view. When they arrive at Rephidim, they are arriving with their children and their livestock. The assumption is when you're on a trip, you pack enough food and water to sustain you for that trip. But the food that they took was not sufficient for their trip from Egypt. The food ran out. In chapter 16, they got manna and quail. The water ran out. My question is, why should these things run out? Why does it appear as though that Moses was unprepared for this trip? Why does it appear as though that God was deliberately causing these people to starve? And to the extent that they're quarreling, people don't just start quarreling. They ask for food. Moses were hungry. Moses says, yeah, I got you. I heard you. A day goes by. Children are hungry. Moses, my children are hungry. Moses says, yeah, sure. I heard you the first time. But another day passes by and days go by. By the time there's a riot, and we know this even in our times, by the time people go on a riot, it's because they have been asking and asking and asking. You're ignoring and ignoring people's needs. And my question is, why should things be desperate? Why can't Moses just go to God and say, God, our food supply is going to end on Friday. Can you please make a plan so by the time Friday's food comes to an end, we have food there? Why should people be led to a desperate situation?
I can answer that in this way, to say that Moses panicked before when God had told him that I'm going to free these people, and Pharaoh made things harder for them. And then Moses comes out and he says, but what kind of a cruel God are you that you allow things to be this way? And God says, what I'm going to become is what Abraham and Jacob have never experienced before. And you're going to have a chance to see that I, as God, actually improve on myself because I cannot be contained. I think God allows situations to become bad because for some reason or the other, when things just drop on our lap, we actually do not have cognizance of what it is that we were in, that God has come through to rescue us from. And I think sometimes heaven allows for these situations to become so desperate so that when we come to God, we say we have tried everything that was within our power. And we know no matter what we could have tried, it was beyond our power. Therefore, truly, that which has been delivered could not have come from the efforts of man, but it is actually something that is coming from God. And I think it is essential. It is essential for our spiritual lives, because if everything just drops, if we become hungry and we just say, God, we want food, and somebody knocks at the door and there's a loaf of bread, where is it that we are actually going to know that we are following this God, not because he gives us the food, but because he's able to give us the food? And I'm just saying that I can never go into the mind of God to actually understand everything to the detail of what he's doing. We say that when we are actually reading, it is actually faith that is seeking understanding from the one that is that we believe in. And I say that what we can do is to speculate. And we have seen countless examples that people that have not struggled and have not suffered towards getting something, they actually do not perceive its value. And they actually are not grateful for the people that have done it. And a lot of parents can attest to this, that when we give things to our kids without them having to work for them or struggle for them, then we find that they actually do not perceive the value and the sacrifice that has been done in provision by the parent. So for me, that is what I can perceive as the reason why God says, I'm going to withhold this thing, because I need to see where you're standing. I've done all of these miracles before, and they fail the test because they still panic, even though they are in the company of the man that is able to do exceedingly more than they could expect.
Okay. And then I was bothered by Moses. Moses replies in verse 2, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? I thought it was a ridiculous question to ask by Moses. Didn't he realize that these people are hungry? I mean, is there no reasonable expectation for these people to quarrel when he is ignoring them? What kind of a question was that?
I think it's a question that is informed by experiential knowledge. I think what Moses had learned at that time is that if it happens to me, it's not happening against me, but it is happening for my benefit. I think this was a mature Moses that was actually trying to get to a part that says that it doesn't matter what I see in front of me, but as long as God is present with me, everything is going to be all right. I think the expression, even though it was a question, it was actually trying to awaken the guys to the presence of God and what that means in our lives. And I'm saying that countless times we run away from God because certain things have not happened to our expectation. And I think if that is a right approach, then we wouldn't see the stories of Joseph in the Bible, who persevered even though they were faced with so much adversity. But he knew that as long as God is present with me, everything is going to end up being all right. And that is why he stands in the terraces of Egypt when he's presented with his firstborn, and he says his name will be Manasseh, for God has made me to forget all of my past problems. It doesn't mean just because we walk with God, everything is going to be easy. But one thing for sure, we know the end result is going to be a God that is going to make us forget all of our past problems, because the end result is going to be so good and so sweet that we're going to say, bring it on, God, bring more suffering just so that I can experience the walk with you as my God. And I think this is a mature Moses that is saying, hey, guys, doesn't help to really worry about these things, because the one we're with, he can do so much more than what we can imagine. And I think that is what we are still looking forward to. We hear John saying that there are streets of gold in heaven. I feel as though we're going to be shocked, because the same Bible says that eye have not seen, nor ear heard, nor heart fathomed the things that God has prepared for us. And I'm saying that there's no way possible that those streets are going to be gold. I think John just saw something that was glittering, and he thought to himself, wow, that has this to be must gold. Be gold.
Yeah.
But when he gets there, we're going to be shocked to say, hey, John, this is not gold, man. But I understand why you said it was gold.
Right.
that is the kind of God that Moses was expressing, that you don't need to panic in the presence of the master. Even if things are looking like they are not going, they've gone to a point of return. Even if Lazarus has already been locked up for 4 days inside the grave, this guy, when he is present, none of those things can exist. And I think that was Moses saying, be patient. God is about to do something here.
If that were true, Mfundisi, verse 4 would not exist. Verse 4 says that Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me. If that were true, if Moses really had this confidence, he wouldn't be crying and worried about what's going to happen. He would stand firm and say, chill, guys. He never said chill. He was frustrated and he went crying out. Verse 4 says Moses cried out to the Lord and didn't even know what to do.
Here's the thing. All I hear that is expressed there is the fact that Moses as a leader was saying that I have less skills and capabilities of actually working within your will, Lord. That is what I hear from that verse. And I think that verse is properly situated there to show that this was not an easy task for Moses to trust in God. But at the same time, he was admitting that, hey, this is beyond what we would say today, my pay grade as a pastor.
Right.
I've done everything. I've prayed. I still believe in you, God. But hey, these people are not budging. What do I do now?
So
I think it was a leadership concern more than a belief in God and a trust in him.
Okay. I'm okay. I'm okay with that theology. However, I am bothered.
I'm on fire today.
What bothers me, however, Mfundisi, is then the whole idea of Moses then concluding this whole experience by calling the place Massa and Meribah. This is found in verse 6. Verse 6 says, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this. Verse 7 then says, and he called the place Massa and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now, this for me is a bit of a problem. It then again underscores him and his own traumas. At no point did God say you must memorialize people's errors. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. Here we have a record of people quarreling, and he memorializes that record of their wrongs. And yet God did not instruct him to do that. The only time we see God instructing him to do something is for him to write down the victory that they experienced against the Amalekites. My question is, why did he give a name to Meribah and Massa? Huh? Why did he keep a record of the Israelites' wrong? What kind of a father is he of this nation? What kind of a leader is this that wants to keep a record that these people quarreled? He gives the place the name Massa and Meribah. What exactly are we to see of Moses? What should we make of Moses?
I think Moses is just like all of us. I think that every time I go through setbacks and things that really scare me, and then I see God coming through, I always keep those things in front of me so that I never forget who it is that I am dealing with. I think Moses was of certainty that things could have gone terribly wrong, but still God was able to come through. And it's very important that we mark these milestones in our lives so that we can be reminded where we are coming from with this God. And I've heard songs like Take Me Back, Lord, to Where I First Believed. And I think the point or the reason the author writes songs like that is because where they are right now, it seems as though things are tough and they want to have that same faith that they had at the time of believing. And therefore, when we memorialize these situations and experiences, they actually stay in our minds as reminders of what it is that God has led us from. It is in a form meant to embarrass whatever thoughts that distrust God in the future, to say, remember the last time that I actually did not trust God. So things we experience, we actually cry about them. But after they have happened and we are relaying the story, after we have seen the end of what we are going through, we no longer relay them with the same tears because we know that the situation ended up in a good space. Therefore, even if we're telling it, like we're talking about an issue of divorce, we no longer cry about it when we know that where we are in a much better place. Instead, we tell it even laughing about it because we ridicule ourselves over the panic that we went through whilst we were going through the situation. And I think Moses was of that mind of as well, that we can't let this thing just pass by. We actually need to draw lessons from it. And the only way we can remember is if it is named, so that from this point, we know what experience we captured with our walk with God.
If that were the case, Mfundisi, perhaps he should have then memorialized his own murder of that Egyptian. He did not memorialize that. He hid the Egyptian and pretended like he did not, like a typical murderer. If that were the case, he should have memorialized his escaping justice. He's a fugitive of justice. He did not want to account for his actions. He ran away like some of the people who run away from justice, who break out of prison, run away. This man, if that were the case, all of these things, him failing to do his job of circumcising his son to the extent that God wanted to kill him, he should have named that place there. Huh? When his wife, Zipporah, decided he's going to do what Moses failed to do, she is going to take a flint knife and circumcise the boys, he should have named that, this is where I failed to do my job and my wife did it for me. If that were the case, why did he not memorialize his own errors, his own failures? Huh?
Here's my thing. Amos says that he takes my sins and throws them in the deep of the sea. And Dr. Gwala says that there are Christians that become submarines that actually go
to
right
dig out, yes,
to go get those sins back. I'm saying that at the time when Moses was killing that man, that Egyptian, what was his state? What was his experience with God? Because the only encounter that I hear of Moses was when he was minding the sheep and he was in exile. And that is when he actually got an encounter. And even when he got that encounter, he says, "Who shall I say you are?" Which means that at the time of him murdering the Egyptian, Moses had not had an encounter with the God that saved him. And I think it would be difficult for us to ask a person that is not even driven by a godly experience to actually memorize the things that they are doing at the time when they are away from God. But I think what we do is we actually look at what you do after your conversion, after your encounter, what you've done. I used to have...
Then let's go to chapter 4. Chapter 4 is where Zipporah saves this coward's life. He's about to die. God wants to kill him because he has not circumcised his son. He was now on his way to Egypt to go and liberate the people. Why did he not memorialize? But at that time, he already had a relationship with God. Why does he not memorialize that place, that lodging place where he was almost killed by God and the woman went into the bush? Imagine it. Because of this weakling, this one, this coward who doesn't want to do the job or his own job, he can't fathom seeing his son, and yet he doesn't memorialize that. Why did he not memorialize that? He already had a relationship with God at that time.
You know, when you called him a coward, I almost remembered a sermon that was preached now at the men's conference of the TOC.
Right.
Where they were talking about men and how they should be like when they are not feminized.
Okay.
But I just want to say to you, Naya, that I had a nightclub in Port Elizabeth at some point, even though I am Adventist born. And I made people drink alcohol. I made them dance throughout the unholy hours. And that was me. That is my experience. It's what I've done. But if you now put it together with who I am today, the two are in direct contrast, because the person that I am today is totally different from the person that I was at that time. There is something that we as Christians do not want to give us a chance on, and that is the process of sanctification. That we feel just because we've all accepted Jesus, then it means that we are all at the same spiritual level. But the experiences that I've gone through, they are not the same as yours. And because of that, our journeys and our paths, they will never be the same. And we take different times to actually come to a full realization of who God is. Peter was with God, was with Jesus every day of his life. But he still failed the test when Jesus was being captured, in that he tried to fight and, you know, they walked away when they saw that he had died and so forth, and it was revived again. And I think in the process of sanctification, we've got strong moments, even though we've had an encounter, that we still need to develop from so that we can be strengthened all around. And it is through our experiences where we actually find the strength to and the discovery of new ways of actually addressing this God. And I think the reason he says that I am, he's trying to say to them, you cannot confine me as God, because I'll surprise you and I'll come through in a way that you've never thought I would. And based upon that, each day, some writer says that he grows sweeter each day because we get a new realization, not because we did not believe, but because he has exposed us to a new side of himself.
So I'm okay with that, Mfundis. And remember, the reason why we've gone down this rabbit hole is because I have an issue with him naming the place where people had their own moment of weakness. And yeah, him memorializing their moment of weakness, keeping a record of their wrong. And yet he himself has his own wrongs, and no one memorialized his moments of weakness. And that's what I'm trying to contest here. Verse 7 is a record of the weakness of the people he's leading. He set a very bad example. And that's why I was asking Funis, so if we are to look at the life and times of Moses, here he was a terrible example of a leader. He memorialized a moment of weakness, and yet he has his own moments of weakness, and no one memorialized it. No one named, put up a monument and says, this is where this coward failed to do his job. This is where this man had his woman do his job for him. No one memorialized that. No one named the place there.
Was it just showing the weakness, or was it also not showing the strength of a God that came through for them at their point of weakness?
Well,
and I think equally so,
yeah,
even if Moses does not memorialize the murder that he ran away from, at the end of the day, he clearly says to God, I'm not the one. I clearly am not the one. I'm sure you've made a mistake. You are sending me to go back to Egypt. And don't you know who I am? You know who I am. And I think it had to be a back and forth with God saying to him, hey, I'm telling you, you're the one. He says, hey, I even stutter. I don't think Moses was actually hiding his weaknesses. The reason he had helpers was because he was actually saying that I am weak. I'm not the one. And I'm trying to say that even if that is not memorialized, it doesn't mean that Moses was running away from who he was. Instead, he was actually showing it. But we see him develop from strength to strength because of the experiences that he was having with the walk with God.
Final question, I'll let you go, Mfundisi. We see then the war, the Amalekite battle between Amalek and Israel. And then God says, write this down, for this is going to be a perpetual war against Amalek from generation to generation. And this question is not necessarily a biblical one, but it's based on verse 16. It's a very current affairs issue. What is happening in Israel now against who they claim is a war against Hamas? Could this be the perpetuation of verse 17, which says from generation to generation? Because you remember Benjamin Netanyahu last year when he started this war on Hamas, he said, remember Amalek. And this is what our own attorneys, when they went to like Raitobi, quoted what Bibi Netanyahu said. Bibi Netanyahu quoting this version about remember Amalek. Is this really what's happening? Is what's happening in Israel right now God's word coming to fruition?
I don't think I would be qualified to actually answer that fully, but I think you are probably just asking for my opinion of it.
Yes, of course.
And my unqualified opinion of it is that no, that is not it. I do not even believe that the people that are actually occupying and calling themselves Israelites are the actual biblical Israelites. So I would first need to actually have somebody convince me
Yes.
that this is the actual issue. And the reason I don't believe has got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It
Right.
actually got to do with the fact that this is a collection of people that were coming from various areas of Europe and so forth
Yes.
that were gathered, and they said that they're going back, and meaning that their forefathers are the people that were said to have been occupying the area and were called the Israelites.
Right.
And all I'm trying to say is that it would be very difficult for me to actually say that this is the actual people that
Fulfillment.
the verse is talking about.
Right.
But one thing for sure, we can derive lessons from actually what is happening there, that it is not just enough for us to call ourselves God's people and that
Right.
God is on our side, when in reality, with our actions, we are not acting in a way that resembles the God that we believe in. And I'm saying that if Israel wants people to be convinced that they are actually God's people, they need to actually slow down on whole lot of other means of fighting and actually be seen to be defenders of the faith, you know, more to be defenders of a trust in Yahweh, to be defenders of the heritage that they've received from a God that always comes through for them. And I think that is what I can actually pull out of that as an example for today's life, that a lot of people will come through and they will be fighting with other people, and they're Christians, but they will be using means that are not showing how big is the God that they are talking about. But I think there's a way that when you are calling on God's name, you also need to represent yourself so that God can be seen in what you're doing and not yourself and your might.
All right, got it. Thank you very much, Mfundisi. I really appreciate your opinion. Unqualified as it is, it was a mouthful. Thank you very much. I am looking
And I
forward
hope
to.
I'm not going to get in trouble for that opinion. But
I
at the end of the day, it is coming from a person that really doesn't know what he's talking about.
I am happy that you have an opinion nonetheless, Mfundisi. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Naya. Thank you, Naya.
All right, that's how we end our show on that segment with Pastor Matlenge, who is, did I say Matlenge? Mabenge,
You
Chanti,
too, Shale.
Mabenge. No, when we meet, we'll see if we can put something on the
You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.